Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is another episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast. This is episode 227. And in this episode, I'll be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam. This will be series 36. So let's just go ahead and get started. Now, I'll be covering a lot of stuff that's related to neuro and OB-GYN in this podcast. And then I'll also say some physiological things if I have enough time. And hopefully, you know, people find this to be helpful. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a patient and this patient, you know, had like an upper respiratory infection or like a UTI or like diarrhea a few days or maybe like 2-3 weeks ago. And then this patient suddenly has been complaining of they've been having like trouble walking and they're now beginning to complain of shortness of breath. If you see that on an MBME, what do you want to think about? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? Remember, most times many people are like, oh, they must have a GI infection, bloody diarrhea, Campylobacter jejuni. Yes, that's a classic presentation, but that's not the only presentation you'd see on a test. Some other things you could see on a test, you could see a person with a UTI, and then they have the symmetric ascending paralysis. If you see that, think about GBS. Or you see a person with an upper respiratory infection, if you see them with a symmetric ascending paralysis, again, think about Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? And remember, Guillain-Barré syndrome, those people, especially when they're beginning to have shortness of breath, you can track their pulmonary status by measuring the FEV1, right? That's very high yield to know. So you track it with the FEV1, and if the FEV1 begins to drop, then your next step in management is to go ahead and intubate the patient, right? You need to go ahead and intubate the patient. Although, if a patient has been intubated for a prolonged period of time, remember, that can increase their risk of a tracheomalacia, right? I mean, like, the biggest MBME exam risk factor for tracheomalacia is having a history of prolonged intubation, right? So that's why usually if you've done any kind of ICU rotation, you'd notice that when people have been intubated for a long enough period of time, you then start having the family discussions about placing them on a trach tube after like 5 to 7 days. So that's a high thing to know there. And obviously, if a person has Guillain-Barré, right, you want to treat it with plasma exchange, right? Instead of putting plasma exchange, because the answer many people have come to expect is plasmapheresis. Instead of putting plasmapheresis, they may put plasma exchange on your test, right? So just kind of watch out for that. And occasionally, I mean, if you don't see plasmapheresis or plasma exchange, you can go ahead and do an IVIG. But the thing is, in general, doing plasmapheresis is the right thing to do on an MBME exam. And one other thing I think I'll go ahead and mention is IVIG is actually a pretty common treatment for some diseases on tests, right? So that's just, you know, one of those things I kind of want you to know about, right? So don't forget that IVIG can be used to treat Bruton's, A-gamma globulinemia, right? IVIG can also be used to treat CVID, like a common variable immunodeficiency, right? If a person has IgA deficiency, you may even help them out a little with IVIG as well, right? But I'll say CVID, Bruton's A-gamma globulinemia, those things respond very well to IVIG. And IVIG is like a second-line treatment for ITP, right? When a person has like immune thrombocytopenia, right? Where they make autoantibodies against GP2B3A. And then remember that if a person has Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? Like, if you check their CSF, you'll have this classic finding of something known as albuminocytologic dissociation, right? So albuminocytologic dissociation because usually if you check a person's CSF, if they have increased amounts of protein, they should have increased amounts of white blood cells, right? Because the protein you see in CSF is usually a derivative of the white blood cells and the inflammation that they carried out in the brain, right? So if you're like, I see like 4+ protein in this person's brain, but I see almost no white blood cells, or you're like seeing like 0 to 2 white blood cells per high power field, right? Those two things are not congruent, right? So there's almost like a disagreement between the amount of protein and the amount of cells you're seeing, right? So that phenomenon is known as albuminocytologic dissociation, right? That phenomenon is known as albuminocytologic dissociation because albumin is the primary protein in the body, right? And cyto means cells, right? So you have like, again, almost like a big disagreement between the protein amount and the cell count, right? So that's something high yield you want to keep at the back of your mind for MBME exams. And then one quick thing I want to kind of run through here is, you know, the things, because again, these things show up all the time on NBMEs. So let's kind of like get them out of our system right now, right? So in general, right, what are the things you do around like 10 weeks of pregnancy, right? You want to go ahead and I mean, that's when you can, you do a urinalysis, right? You typically do a urinalysis, you know, pretty early in pregnancy at like the first visit, right? You know, you go ahead and check for bacteria in the urine, right? And if you find bacteria in the urine, you actually treat. In general, when women have asymptomatic bacteriuria, you don't treat, with the big exception being pregnancy. Okay, when a woman is pregnant, if she has dirty urine, right, so let's say you find like bacteria, even if she has zero symptoms, right, you find like bacteria, or you find like a positive leukocyte esterase or positive nitrites, right, you need to go ahead and treat. And after you treat, you need to perform a repeat urinalysis as a test of cure. If it's not cured, you need to treat it again, right? That's a very high yield thing to know, right? And you typically do that around, like, again, at the first prenatal visit, which usually happens around 10 weeks. And remember that around that 10-week period, you can also do like a chorionic villus sampling, right? You know, if you kind of want to check out the chorionic villi, you just want to see like, oh, if you want to do like some kind of DNA, whatever, right? If you want to check like the child's DNA, like you can do like CVS, you can do cell-free DNA. Cell-free DNA, you can probably do it like just before 10 weeks or at 10 weeks. Chorionic villus sampling is something that, you know, you typically do like around like 12 weeks or thereabouts, right? So again, that's a high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind. And one other thing, so I guess since we've kind of talked around 10 weeks, right, like if you're going between like, you know, like that 15 to 20 week mark, probably a little closer to the 20 week mark, you can begin to do things like an amniocentesis, right? You can do an amniocentesis, although you don't just jump to an amniocentesis, right? Like you need to have a reason for doing an amniocentesis. And usually that reason is you're like, you have an elevated maternal serum AFP, right? If the maternal serum AFP is elevated, right, they will try to ask for your next step in management on the NBME, and they will give you an amniocentesis as an answer choice. Resist the temptation to pick an amniocentesis as an answer choice, because the thing is, if you see an elevated maternal serum AFP, it can be from a neurotube defect, right? It can be from a neurotube defect, but it can also be from an abdominal body wall defect, like an omphalocele, for example, right? So the thing is, those are things you can see very easily on an ultrasound. So you better make sure an ultrasound has been done in the Q-stem before you pick amniocentesis as an answer on an NBME exam. If an ultrasound has not been done, that is your next step after an elevated maternal serum AFP, right? You do an ultrasound. If you don't see anything on an ultrasound, that's where you do an amniocentesis. And please do not forget, if you perform an amniocentesis, you need to give that woman Rogam at that point, right? Because remember, yes, we typically give Rogam like, you know, between like 24 to 28 weeks. But if you have anything that causes mixing of fetal and maternal blood, you need to absolutely make sure that you give a Rogam, right? Anytime you have any of those fancy things, like you do like percutaneous umbilical blood sampling or whatever, for example, you need to do, you need to give Rogam during those situations, right? So again, that anatomic ultrasound, yada, 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 right? You do it around like 18 weeks. But officially, you can do it over like 15 to 20 weeks, right? And again, you can do an amniocentesis after 15 weeks, okay? And then one other thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is that, I guess with the 24 to 28 weeks, right, there are some things you can do, right? So you can give like Rogam, right? That's when you screen for gestational diabetes as well, right? Those are probably like the two big high yield things you want to remember between the 24 to 28 week period, right? And the thing is, on NBMEs, if a woman is diagnosed with gestational diabetes, your next step in management on an NBME is to give her insulin, right? The thing is, according to ACOG, you can use metformin. You can use some of the sulfonylureas, but according to the NBME, at least in very recent times, right, insulin is still the diabetic drug of choice on NBMEs, right? And remember, if a kid has if a woman has diabetes, right, you know, they can give you a question where essentially the size will be greater than dates from polyhydramnios, right? The size will be greater than dates from the polyhydramnios, right? Because again, all that glucose in the mom's blood will flow into the baby's blood. So the baby will pee a ton, because remember, amniotic fluid is literally a baby peeing and swallowing. Peeing and swallowing his pee. Peeing and swallowing his pee, right? So that can be one high-yield cause of polyhydramnios on an NBME. I mean, there are many other things that can cause polyhydramnios, for example, right? Like If you have like an obstruction of the GI tract, like say TE fistula or duodenal atresia or jejunal atresia, right? Then the baby will swallow, but the swallowed thing cannot move forward. So the baby will stop swallowing after a while. That can cause polyhydramnios. Again, that will present a size greater than 8. So the woman may be at like 32 weeks gestation, and the length from the pubic symphysis to the fundus of the uterus is like 37 centimeters, right? Another thing that can cause polyhydramnios is if the rostral neuropore fails to close, right, then the swallowing center is gone, right? If the swallowing center is gone, then that kid can get into trouble with anencephaly, right? So you essentially wear away the cortex, and that wear away the swallowing center, right? That's a high yield thing to keep in mind for exams. And then oligohydramnios, right? That will be the reverse, right? Size less than dates. That will be something like Potter sequence, where you're not peeing as a child. Or if a child has like posterior urethral valves, that's causing like an obstructive nephropathy, right? Again, the pee would not come out, so you would not see that amniotic fluid. So again, those are all kind of high yield things to know for exams, right? And then the thing is, if a woman is around like 32, 34-ish weeks, one high yield thing to keep at the back of your mind is you can begin to, especially if it's a woman that, has, multiple sexual partners, like very high risk of STIs, you can actually begin to test her for diseases like, in fact, the way I remember this as SHGC, right? Syphilis, HIV, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. You test for those things, I forgot to mention, you test for those things at the first prenatal visit, around like 10 weeks. But if a woman, again, is high risk, you need to repeat that testing around like 32-ish to like 34 weeks. And then some key things you want to remember around this time frame is, if a woman is about to have a baby, like a preterm baby, and it's less than 32 weeks, there are two things you need to give. You need to give steroids, right, to promote fetal lung maturity. You give it as two doses over a 24-hour period. And then you also need to give magnesium to decrease the risk of cerebral palsy, right? The buzzword you may see on the test is for neuroprotection, if you may, right? And then remember that if a woman is less than 34 weeks, right, but greater than 32 weeks, the only thing you need to give is betamethasone for fetal lung maturity. You don't need to give MAG. MAG is only given if you're less than 32 weeks for neuroprotection. And then one thing to remember, right, between like 35 to 37 weeks, that's when you start testing for group B strep, right? That's when you start testing for group B strep, right? You start testing for group B streptococcus. And if it's positive, obviously you're going to treat. And usually those women, when they come in labor, right, you give them like ampicillin, just to, make sure the baby does not get a strep agalactiae. And then, in general, right, like once a woman is like more than 41 weeks along, you need to start like telling her, okay, you're not having labor, let's go ahead and, give her like prostaglandins or something to kind of ripen your cervix so you can go ahead and have this, have this baby, right? So again, those are all high yield things to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And one, I guess, since I've kind of talked about these dates, let me just say some other things around that pregnancy period. Again, my apologies. I will try to keep this podcast pretty short. I know it's pretty info dense, but this is all floridly high yield information that I want you guys to know for exams, right? So in general, right, like there's this thing that you may check for in mom's blood, right? You may check for this, I think it's called like pregnancy associated plasma protein A, like PAP A, like PAPPA, right? Typically, that is usually decreased when a kid has like a trisomy or something like that, right? So that's one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then remember, if you do the quad screen, right, remember in Down syndrome, the beta HCG and the inhibin A will be increased on a quad screen. The other stuff will be normal or decreased, right? And then if a person has Edwards syndrome, right? So trisomy 18, they will have low levels of alpha-fetoprotein, estriol, and beta-HCG. The inhibin may be increased or normal, okay? But they will have low levels of AFP, estriol, and beta-HCG on an MBME exam, right? And again, remember I said around 10 weeks you can do the cell-free DNA. In general, they can actually give you like a very weird question on the test where, this person has a positive cell-free DNA, and what's your next best step in management? Your next best step is actually to do like a chorionic villus sampling, right? Or you can do an amniocentesis, right? The thing is, again, the cell-free DNA is great and all, right? But if it's positive, you need to follow it up with a diagnostic test like an amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling, right? And then don't forget, the moment a baby is born, before the baby leaves the hospital, the baby is supposed to get the Hep B vaccine, right? The baby, again, it's very high yield to know, the baby is supposed to get the Hep B vaccine when they have, before they leave the hospital, at least the very first series in the Hep B vaccine. And again, don't forget that before I said that you give a mom Rogam between 24 to 28 weeks, right? The thing is, you also need to give mom Rogam before she leaves the hospital, after she has just delivered the baby, right? So the thing you typically do, though, before you give the Rogam is you need to do a test to figure out how much of baby's blood has mixed with mom's blood. You don't just give Rogam willy-nilly, right? The reason there is when a person has if you see that there's very little baby's blood that mixed with mom's blood, right? The prudent thing to do is to give low amount, like very little amount of Rogam, right? But if you see that there's a ton of baby's blood mixing with mom's blood, right? You give larger amounts of Rogam, right? So you may be like, okay, divine, who cares? Why do I care about this? Well, the thing is, there is a test you do to determine how much maternal fetal blood mixing has happened. And that test is something that your friends at the MBA may expect you to know. And that test is known as the Kleihauer-Betke test, okay? The Kleihauer-Betke test. It's Kleihauer. The Kleihauer-Betke test. The Betke is Betke. You know, Bet like the TV station. No, the cable channel, not the T. It's not a TV station. So, Betke. So, the Kleihauer-Betke test, okay? Again, that's high yield to know for MBA exams. And then, I think those are kind of like the big things I want to say around pregnancy. Although one other thing I want to say is, it's just a classic question that people kind of screw up on exams. If a woman has HIV, right, and she delivers a baby and you're like, ooh, does this child have HIV? That's a classic question. If you find IgG against like the P24 antigen in the baby's serum, that doesn't mean the baby has HIV. Right? Because that IgG, if you remember from step one, it may have crossed the placenta, right? It may have crossed the placenta, and that would give you like almost like a false result, right? So that IgG you find in the baby's serum doesn't mean the baby has been exposed to HIV. The thing that will make you super, super worried on an MBME exam is if you notice that, this baby has IgM against like a HIV protein, like the P24 protein. If you see that, then because you won't be, remember, IgM is the first antibody you make in response to any antigen, right? So if you see IgM, the baby has HIV. And then at that point, you have to do like HIV RNA. Your next step on the test will be to do some kind of like HIV RNA testing. Now, one other thing I want to talk about here is, this is a phenomenon I've kind of talked about in other podcasts, but I want to talk about it here because there are some new things I want to add, right? So the thing is, I've described this in like some old cardiology podcasts, but remember that your systolic blood pressure is a surrogate for your cardiac output, right? Because many people think that, the moment I'm done with step one, I break free from all these physiology questions that the MBME loves to test. Well, sorry, newsflash. Your friends at the MBME, they don't stop testing physiology questions after you take step one. On step two, CK, and on step three, you'll still see all these questions that have arrows, or they give you lab values like for different disorders, and you need to pick out the one that matches to the diagnosis in the question, right? So let me describe a physiologic scenario that, again, many people tend to screw up on exams. The thing is, your cardiac output is a surrogate for your systolic blood pressure. Your systemic vascular resistance is a surrogate for your diastolic blood pressure. Why is that important? The thing is, the MBME, they love to ask questions about things that could widen a person's pulse pressure. For example, I already talked about, and again, I've described this pathophysiology in other podcasts. Because this is a rapid review podcast, I'm not going to waste a ton of time with that. But you've heard me say this many times in many podcasts, that if a person has a patent ductus arteriosus, or they have aortic regurge, those things will cause a wide pulse pressure on MBME exams, right? Another one I've said is, I've talked about how a person taking like a drug like Myrinone, right? Remember, Myrinone is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. So by inhibiting phosphodiesterase, right, it would increase cyclic AMP. When you have high levels of cyclic AMP in cardiac muscle, it causes more contraction. So if you have more contraction, you have an increased cardiac output. So your systolic blood pressure will go up, right? But The thing is, by being a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, it also raises cyclic AMP in other kinds of muscle, like smooth muscle, for example. And the thing is, when cyclic AMP is elevated in smooth muscle, that causes smooth muscle relaxation. So that will cause vasodilation, and that will decrease the systemic vascular resistance. If you decrease the systemic vascular resistance, right, that will decrease the person's diastolic blood pressure. So the pulse pressure, which is the difference between the systolic blood pressure and the diastolic blood pressure, will get wider. It would increase when a person is given murine. Well, one other thing your friends at the MBMA have started caring about in recent times is a person that is in septic shock. What happens to the pulse pressure in septic shock? So let's think about this for a second. In septic shock, right, this person has systemic inflammation. And because they have systemic inflammation, right, they've released all these inflammatory mediators like histamine, bradykinin, heparin, and all that stuff. And it's very high yield to remember that those things increase vascular permeability, and those things dilate blood vessels. So when a person has septic shock, they actually have a decrease in systemic vascular resistance. And if they have a decrease in systemic vascular resistance, it'll be much easier for blood to flow out of the heart, right? Because there's essentially like less of an impediment to blood flow from the heart, right? So if that happens, right, their cardiac output actually does increase, at least early in a person that has a septic shock. They'll have an increase in cardiac output, and they have a decrease in systemic vascular resistance. So based on what I've said, you should already begin to imagine that the pulse pressure gets wider in septic shock, right? And in general, if people have wide pulse pressure, they'll begin to have, because when you check a person's like radial pulse, for example, that pulse you are feeling is the spread between those people's systolic and diastolic blood pressures. So if the spread between a person's systolic and diastolic blood pressure goes up, which is again what is known as pulse pressure, it should come as no surprise that people that have wide pulse pressure physiology tend to have bounding pulses and head bobbing and all that fancy stuff that you see on a physical exam. So those are again all high yield things that unfortunately you do need to know for purposes of the USMLEs. So I'm going to go ahead and pause here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? Step one, step two CK. I'll talk about my life lesson at the end. But, you know, step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. And I offer these booster courses. It's 20 hours for step one, step two CK, or step three. And basically, it's like a very high yield course, very rapid fire course, where we review the must-knows for those respective USMLE exams. Again, I've done it with tons of people. Many people have found it helpful. Many people have found like very big score increases from going through those things, right? And then obviously I also do traditional tutoring where I tutor you for like your entire dedicated period. Or there are these things I call like longitudinal tutoring. I've done it with a bunch of people where if you're like a first-year med student starting off med school, I tutor you through all your block exams in med school, and then I tutor you for your dedicated period. Or if you're, you know, like a newly minted third-year med student. I know there's not much of that with this virus that's kind of going around. If you're, you know, like a newly minted med student, third-year med student, and you're studying off rotations, I tutor you for your shelf exams, and then I tutor you for step two. The thing is, you may say, why does this thing help? The thing is, as I tutor you for those exams that come before your USMLE exam, I essentially teach you the must-knows, the high yields. Like, I'm essentially it's almost like a one-year prep or two-year prep in the case of a first-year med student for step one. And by the end of that period, as I work with you, you would have built up like a super solid base of knowledge. Many of these people that I've done this with, they end up taking very little dedicated time to study for the exams, and they crush it really hard, right? So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. And then I also offer tutoring for like the MCAT, right? So like if you have like a college buddy that needs tutoring for any of the MCAT subjects, so for like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, I tutor for all those things. And then if you are a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, again, I've worked with tons of people for pretty much every specialty. And again, most people I've worked with, they've matched their first choice. So if you have like an odd thing about your application, low scores, graduated from med school years ago, failed a USMLE exam, I have worked with people with all these kinds of problems. Again, I've been an admissions committee member, right? So I know how to essentially help you put your best foot forward with your application, mock interviews, personal statements, rec letters, editing your application, all that stuff. Again, I can help you with those things. And again, most people I've worked with have matched their first choices. And then if you're a resident, I need tutoring for like the, if you're a medicine resident or a peds resident, I need tutoring for the in-training exam or the board exam for each of those specialties. I do offer tutoring for those things. And then my life lesson, and actually, please don't forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel. Thank you for all those that have been subscribing. It's called Divine Intervention, USMLE podcasts and videos. Please subscribe to the YouTube channel, subscribe to the WordPress website, or also subscribe to the podcast. It's like on Apple Podcasts, it's on Spotify, it's on Google Play. So please subscribe. Some people have asked me about like putting the earlier podcasts on those things. I've tried. For whatever reason, there's like a limit on how many podcasts I can put on those things. So I will try to reach out to like Apple customer care or something to see if they can help. But I can't guarantee anything now with this virus. Things are kind of busy on my end. So I'll try to see what I can do about that. And if you want to reach out to me, right, for like children or anything, you can either reach out to me through the website or you can, I mean, it's called Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end .com. Or you can send me an, or just do a Google search for Divine Intervention Podcast. You'll find it there. Or you can send me an email at Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. And I, you know, I tend to respond pretty quickly. So my life lesson for today is the value of not comparing yourself with other people. What do I mean by that? This is a very common med student problem, right? You see some people, they feel that the only way they can make headway in life is by putting other people down, or they feel that they have to hide certain things from people in life for them to move forward. The thing is, to be honest with you, the person that is devoted to helping other people is the person that tends to succeed the most and the person that tends to succeed the fastest. And it's the person that ends up being on top. That's the truth, right? Many times people think that, oh, by trying to one-up another person, you can succeed that way. Don't get me wrong, you can. But that success is usually very transient. And that thing at some point in your career or some point in your med school life will backfire, right? The thing is, it's always better to just help people out. But let me say this though. Here's one area you need to be careful. You can help people, right? But you can't help people more than, I mean, there's this Bible verse that says, love your neighbor as you love yourself, right? Not more than you love yourself, right? So don't let people walk all over you, right? Or don't put yourself in like a terrible circumstance because you're trying to help people. But the thing is, you can construct win-win relationships. You can help other people, you can help yourself, and both of you succeed, right? That's the thing, like comparing yourself with other people, that's just usually not a good idea. Usually not a good idea, right? So always try to help people. Don't always try to one-up other people. Don't be the person that you're on a rotation and you bring cookies and cake for all the residents, right? Or you all agree with your classmates, oh, let's all come in at 6 a.m. and then you come in at 4:30. No, that's not a good thing to do. And the thing is, residents and attendants see through this, right? And you can almost guarantee you probably get bad evals doing that. Some people get away with that, but it's just icky. That's just not a good way to be a team player. I mean, I would not want to work with those kinds of people in residency, to be perfectly honest with you. So that's my life lesson for today. So thank you for listening and please stay safe. Be careful, practice social distancing. And remember that, at least that's my prayer, that this thing kind of passes off soon, because I mean, it's killing a lot of people and it's, I mean, I've never seen anything like this in my life, but you know, just be careful, stay safe, stay indoors, protect others by staying indoors. That's a very important thing. Thank you for listening. I'll see you in the next podcast whenever I have the time. Thank you and God bless you.